first thing I used to do after church on a Sunday morning with my slight OCD was to run to the toilet and wash my hands because it smelt of lots of kind of interesting people's hands who'd been shaking. But hey, that's just my childhood experience. I'll leave you to have your own. But anyway, we share the peace as a church. And the Bible is full of references to peace. In fact, Jesus himself is called the Prince of Peace. And he says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. And so peace is massively significant for us. But it's not just for Christians, because if you step outside the church, you will find there are people talking about wanting to receive inner peace, whatever they mean by that. And there are people who are talking about going for peace crisis talks at the moment all over the world. We are a world that is craving peace, longing for peace, talking up peace, praising peace. And yet it doesn't take long looking around us, looking at our own family situations and people we know, and looking at the news and the global situation to know all too easily that peace does not seem to be something we are particularly good at as a human race. In fact, I'd go so far as saying we're pretty pants at doing peace and doing it well. We only need to look at the world, at the global conflicts, and look our own lives and know the issues that we see with people we love, people who haven't talked together for years because of things that have gone on. We're just not very good at peace. I want to suggest to you, perhaps before we get stuck into the passage, some of the theology of why this might be. And I'm willing to be critiqued on this afterwards, but here are some thoughts to start us off. I believe, and I know this is true, that God is just. In him is found perfect justice. In him is justness itself. And we are amazingly made in his image. That doesn't just mean that we look physically like him, so I don't think that's necessarily the case, but it does mean that all the good attributes that are found in God, he entrusted onto us at the point of creation. And so God's sense of justice, when Adam and Eve were first formed from the mud, was found in them. The very nature of God was found in mankind. And yet, like all of our attributes, all the good things, all the good gifts that God was given us on the birth of our creation and when we came from the womb and were born on this earth, it's been corrupted and twisted in us to become self-serving and self-seeking. So justice, which is something godly and something good and something which should be sought at great cost, has become something which is self-seeking and has stopped meaning how can we see real justice in the world, and has started to mean how can I get my own way. It's stopped being about justice, it's started being about, well, that's not fair for me. Why shouldn't I get my own way on that? And if that's not something you recognise in yourself, it's certainly something that I recognise in me. In fact, I call this longing to not just get equal and get fairness, but to get one perhaps over on those who get one over on me, a deeply ingrained sense of one-upmanship in ourselves. And we all know we have this at that point when you walk away from an argument or a conversation or something at work, and you know at the back of your mind when there's ringing, oh, I should have said that. Bother, that would have shown them. And then sometimes I mull that over for weeks, replaying the conversation and the situation, thinking they would have looked so stupid. Oh, next time I'll think of something slightly quicker on my feet. We have a deeply ingrained sense that we want to get one over on other people, and we perhaps wouldn't put it like that, but we certainly don't want someone to get one over on us. We don't want to look the fool, because, well, it wounds our pride, it wounds who we are. And so there's something in us which is unwilling to come off second best, and so peace is all too often hard to achieve. It's not just a case on an international level, as we see conflicts which happen where governments just can't let something go and have to make sure that they're always looking strong in front of each other, and so situations escalate. It's true for us as well, and it's been true throughout history. In fact, the Apostle Paul writes in Philippians 4 verse 2 about two people who we hear nothing about, but he says this: I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche Someone can correct my Greek afterwards. Underused baby names, I think, today, but there you go. I plead with these two women to agree with each other in the Lord. And then he tells the church, help these women. Help these people to get along. You see, people falling out, people lacking peace, people... it's always been there. It's always been an issue. And in fact, across human cultures, we've always had things in place. Choke in a manly way, hang on. There's always been systems in place to try and prevent this issue becoming absolute bloodshed. So, if we look at the Germanic tribes in Western Europe, of which the Angles, that the Brits were a part, they all had the same system of wergild. And wergild was essentially a blood payment. So, if you killed my brother, very uncouth of you to do so, I must say. My natural tendency would be to go and kill your cousin and perhaps another distant relative, so I got equal and then I got some. And then, of course, your wider family would say, that's not on, let's go kill him and a couple of his distant relatives as well. And so things escalate. And so, because of that human tendency, a system was put in place called wergild. And wergild was basically a payment that was set in English law up till the 12th century, when the judicial system took over more centralised, whereby there were agreed amounts of money that lives were worth. So if you kill my brother, I mean, I wouldn't object. No, I would, sorry, that's... If you kill my brother, then you would have to give me money, and if I were to accept that amount of money, then I'd legally acknowledge that I was not going to get revenge. Very clever systems make sure things didn't escalate, because you don't want all your working people dead. It's not very good for the economy. At the same time, in the Old Testament, we read a really, really clever law, which is just and fair, which says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Now, this means that if you take my eye, which I'd rather you didn't, but each to their own, this means that I have a right to take your eye in return, but I'm not to take your eye and then kick you in the shins. That would be to escalate the violence, and then I would be held at fault in a court of law. You see, it's a really, really clever system. If you steal £5 off me, I can take £5 off you, but I can't take five and then some. And so it stops this cycle of escalation. It stops this cycle of one-upmanship, of trying to get one over on you. But the problem is, even then, it's not a perfect solution, because there's still two people who lack eyes. And that's not great for the NHS or anyone else. You see, the problem is in built in us. And of course, Gandhi famously said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And I think I agree with that. And I think Jesus showed us when he came a different way. And so we come to the story now of Laban and Jacob. Now, the Bible is full of stories of people and groups who are up for a bit of one-upmanship on each other. Cain famously killed Abel because he got one up on him in terms of his worshipping before God. You have in the New Testament, you have the Pharisees and the Sadducees always looking for a chance, two religious groups, to make the other ones look stupid. That the Bible's full of this. But the two masters, the two absolutely excellent, the two tricksters par excellence, I think the term would be, are of course Jacob and Laban. Here are two people who have not just got good at one-upmanship, they've made the whole thing into an art form. They are brilliant at it. And of course, earlier on, as we look at Jacob as a young man, we've seen him get one up over both his brother Esau, who should have had lots of birthrights and other things going on, and his father as well. And in fact, he's had to flee to Laban, because here is someone who's safe, who's away from the situation. So he's fleed to Laban in safety. But in Laban, he's met his match, because the man is a bit of a genius when it comes to manipulating situations and getting one over someone else. And so, while Jacob's been there, because Jacob's got a calling from God, and because his grandfather was Abraham, who was given a specific promise, and his father was Isaac, who inherited that promise made to Abraham, and Jacob's the son of Isaac, and therefore he's inherited this promise. God has a specific plan for Jacob, and so where Jacob goes, God blesses him and looks after him. And so, even though he goes to Laban, and he fancies his daughter, so he works for 7 years to marry her. And then he's fooled, so he marries the wrong daughter, Leah, and then has to work for another 7 years to justify marrying the daughter he actually fancied, which was Rachel, as well. See, he's been tricked brilliantly got won up over him by Laban, who's now got free labour for 14 years in return for two daughters. A great deal, I hear, in biblical times. And on top of that, he's then made to work another 6 years if he wants to make any money for himself. So Jacob does this. He works faithfully for Laban. And Jacob this whole time is trying to trick and manipulate and get one up over Laban. And he tries all sorts of tricks and clever things to get more of the flock, more of the resources, the goats and the sheep, to belong to him. But the thing is, while Jacob's manipulating, he doesn't see that behind the scenes God's blessing what he's doing anyway. And so God blesses Jacob tremendously in spite of his slight issues that we've seen in passage after passage. And Jacob eventually becomes very wealthy. And so Laban and his family go, this Jacob is getting slightly wealthy. And Jacob begins to hear mutterings that perhaps his life might be in danger. What if Laban turns on him? And so he decides that it might be time to get out of there and take his wealth and do a runner. In fact, this is confirmed by God. And God says to him, Jacob, it's time to go again. It's time to move back to the place where you ran away from all those years ago and start afresh. That calling I gave to your grandfather and your father, I'm now calling you back to go to the land and be someone special. And so Jacob does this. But as per normal, rather than doing it in a God-honoring way, he decides to manipulate the situation, perhaps out of fear, perhaps out of worry, perhaps out of sheer one-upmanship over Laban. So he gets his two wives together, Laban's daughters, and they come up with a plan that they're going to run away in the night and get as far away as they can while Laban's away. And so they do this. He gets Rachel and Leah, he gets all their flocks and herds, all their family members, all their servants, the whole clan together. And while Laban's away, they flee into the night. And 3 days later, they're still fleeing when Laban finds out what's happened. So of course, Laban isn't very happy about this. He's especially not happy when, as a side plot and an interesting note, it turns out that his family gods, his idols, have gone missing. And unbeknown to Jacob, but on the way out, Rachel, his wife, pocketed them and did a runner. So Laban's unhappy because he's lost his daughters, he's lost his flocks, which he still sees as his, even though Jacob's earned them by right. And he's also lost his family idols. So he gathers all the mighty men he could muster, and they chase after him. And 7 days later, they catch up to Jacob. And here, a scene of brilliant verbal dexterity ensues. As Laban arrives and his people, something like West Side Story, I like to imagine, as they all click and approach each other. And the two sides line up. And Laban starts off, and he says, "Oi! Jacob," I'm paraphrasing here, by the way, so bear with me. You can find more of the story at the start of Genesis chapter 31. "Oi, Jacob, what do you think you're doing running off in the night, taking my herds and my goods and my daughters? You have no right to do this. And on top of that, you have nicked my family gods. What were you thinking?" He slates him. The language in terms of the culture of the time is so strong. He's publicly shaming Jacob and threatening him. Jacob here is taking a complete beating of the pride. And so Jacob, in retaliation, when Laban's quite finished, unbeknownst to him, of course, Rachel's stolen the gods, but he thinks he's in the right on this one. He says, "Fine. Firstly, I'm justified in running away, but we'll come to that in a little bit. But as to these gods, nothing to do with me, I promise you. So search wherever you want, search wherever you want, and if you find them on any of my people, I will kill them dead. That sounds like a fair arrangement to me." And so now the plot thickens, and Laban goes from tent to tent. He goes to Jacob's tent, no gods there. Goes to Leah's tent, no gods there. Goes to Rachel's tent. And we, the viewers of this situation, go, he's going to find them. But as he searches the tent, the narrator changes the dynamic and says, actually, the family gods were being hidden by Rachel. And she was sitting down on some luggage from the back of the camel, and she'd hidden the gods inside it, and she was sitting down. So Laban comes out of Rachel's tent, still not finding the gods, and Rachel turns to him and says, "Sorry, father, I'm having my period. So I can't stand up to greet you formally. So I'm afraid that's that." And Laban, as dads have done throughout the ages, went, "Okay, then, that's fine," and walks away. So the gods remain unfound. And now it's Jacob's turn, because Jacob remoralized, realizing that he's won the first victory and he's still in the right, and Laban's tried to shame him, but he now looks like a fool. Jacob takes his turn, and Jacob completely slates Laban. He points out that he worked for him for 14 years to win his two daughters and got not a penny for it. In all that time, he looked after the flocks and he went above and beyond the laws of the land, so that when one of the lambs died, when it wasn't on Jacob's watch, even then Jacob was made to, by Laban, pay the money for that lamb out of his own pocket. He'd been treated really badly. And he worked for 6 years fairly, and he'd taken what was rightfully his under the agreement of the contract, which Laban kept trying to manipulate. And now Laban's chasing him down, which he knew he would do, which is why Jacob ran off in the night anyway. So shouldn't you just leave me alone? Now Laban at this point knows that he's lost the argument. He's been publicly shamed. He's looked stupid because he couldn't find the God, and his accusations came to nothing. And so he's been made a fool of. A complete fool. He's been slated. Jacob has utterly got one up over him. And so he realizes he's got no option but to draw a line in the sand. And so we come finally to the start of our passage. And we're not going to be here all night, I promise. Don't worry. In verse 43, Laban answers Jacob after Jacob has slated him. He says, "The woman are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All you see is mine! Yet what can I do today about these daughters of mine or about the children they have borne? Come, make a covenant, you and I. Let it serve as a witness between us." And that's sort of a whatever, let's work this out. Now, this may sound very reasonable to you and I, but what's actually going on here is Laban is refusing to acknowledge in any way, shape or form Jacob's right to his daughters originally. To marry his daughters. He's ignoring the fact that Jacob's worked his socks off for him for 20 years and been faithful and fair. And he's ignoring, most of all, the fact that God has blessed Laban because Jacob's worked for him faithfully. So Jacob has every right in this situation to say, "Laban," because everyone in the area is now on Jacob's side, "Laban, you are wrong. You should give me some kind of payment, some kind of reconciliation. I should slate you, I should shame you, I should do something. I'm going to escalate this situation." Because as we look back over Jacob's life, that's what Jacob does. He always gets his own way. He never comes out second. He always ends up on top. And if he's winning, if he's going to win the battle, he's going to carry on doing it. But something amazing here happens. Something has changed in Jacob, and a man who is still broken, a man who is not perfect. Something's changed. The process of transformation has taken root in these 20 years' service, these 20 years of reflection on the ways that he wronged his brother, his families, and perhaps even God. And Jacob, rather than trying to get one up, he takes a stone. And he places it between him and Laban. And he says to his relatives, "Gather more stones." So they took the stones and they piled them up in a heap and they ate there by the heap. And Laban called it Jagar Shahadutha, correct my pronunciation afterwards, and Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today." That's why it was called Galeed. That literally means heap of witness. And so by these stones, the two men, the two families, the two clans are reconciled. The peace is made, bloodshed's avoided, hatred is stemmed, and it all ends okay. I wouldn't say it ends well. In fact, in the last line we see when Laban says goodbye to his daughters and his grandchildren, he kisses them goodbye, but there is no farewell for Jacob. The two men have had it with each other. There's no more love between them. But at least, at the very least, out of all this brokenness, out of all this mess, there is peace, there is hope, and there is time for both men to go away and to rebuild. You see, if we want to see peace in this world, if we want to see peace in our lives, if we want to be made right with the people that have hurt us and upset us, if we want those relationships where years of bitterness has sometimes gone between us and other people, and hatred and hatred and anger has built up. Be it family, be it friends, be it distant relatives, be it colleagues, be it whoever. Then something has to change. We have to lay down our right to get one over on someone else. We have to lay down our right to one-upmanship. We have to lay down our right to revenge. We even have to lay down our right to get the last word in a situation. And it is only when we are willing to do this, it's only when governments or when people or when situations are willing to do this that we can have peace. The most amazing situation perhaps in recent history on an international level or a national level is the end of apartheid in South Africa. I know it's an imperfect situation, I know there's all sorts of mess, I know there's all sorts of things that have gone on since and will continue to do so. But here's a situation that should have erupted in bloodshed. Here's a situation which was predicted by all the political commentators to be a situation that would end with civil war, with pain, with anguish, with revenge killings. And yet, largely speaking, it didn't. And it didn't because some very courageous people made the decision that they were going to let go of their right to revenge. And through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, headed up by Desmond Tutu, 1,500 amnesties were granted to people who had done some horrendous things. Now, on some level, we go, but we want to see justice. And there was justice done in many situations. But there could not have been peace in South Africa, there couldn't be democracy there, I truly believe, unless people were willing to talk to each other and let go of their desire to get revenge on one another. And through that amazing work, we see modelled the message of the gospel, which is when we love each other, when we listen to each other, and we lay down ourselves and lay down our rights and we lay down our longing and our pride to get one up over other people or other nations or other situations, then we can have peace and we can have love and we can in the process be transformed. Isn't that the most amazing truth? And I'll tell you what, if Jacob can do this, if Jacob the trickster, the master of one-upmanship, can go on this process, this journey of being transformed, then we can too. I know there'll be some of you who have people you perhaps haven't talked to for years, or if you have, it's been really challenging. I know that is. And you might say to me, but Tim, you don't understand. You don't know what this person did to me. You don't know how much pain I'm carrying and how much lack of justice was done unto me. You don't get that. And you're right, I don't. But what I do know from personal experience and from sharing time with others and from reading scripture is that when we hold on to bitterness and we're unwilling to make peace, the only people that get really, really, really hurt isn't the people we're trying to hurt, it's ourselves. And if you want freedom and if you want release and if you want to know the joy of life and the joy of Christ, then one of the first steps to that is getting over our pride and being willing to make peace. So here's what we're going to do. In a moment, the band are going to come up and worship. In a bit, we're going to share some communion together, and we're going to remember that God made peace with us. The most amazing example, perhaps in all history, of a peace that's undeserved. The great party of God Almighty being willing to make peace with us, though it was undeserved. He didn't hold on to his right to say, no, I'm not having anything to do with you, but instead died in our place so that we can be reconciled to him. Flip me, that's amazing. But that's aside. What we're going to do now is, you'll notice to the side of the church is there are two piles of cardboard boxes. There's one over there and there's one over there. And these are going to be our heaps of witnesses. And in a moment we're going to stand and we're going to sing and we're going to worship together. And while we do that, if there is anyone in your heart that you would like to be able to say, I forgive you, and if you'd like to be able to say, I can't on my own forgive this person, I can't be the first one to make peace, then what I'd like you to do, I'd like you to go over to the piles of witness, the heaps of witness, and as a symbol between you and God, while you go over to there, I just want you to come before God and say, Lord, give me the strength to make things right with this person. Give me the strength to make things right with them. I don't mind how you do that. It's helpful for me to get up and do something physical and when there's a moment, so I'd like you to go and do that if that's relevant to you. And if you'd like someone to pray that through with you, then there are chairs nearby. Sit in one of the chairs at the sides and someone will come to find you. But while that goes on, we're going to sing and worship a great God who made peace with us, the God of peace, the Prince of peace, the Lord of lords, and the King of kings, and then we're going to share communion together.